You're listening to an encore performance of The Jim Engster Show, so please hold your calls.
This is Jim Engster. Coming today on the show, we'll visit with film producer John Hardy. It was 25 years ago this summer that the classic film Sex, Lies, and Videotape was produced right here in Baton Rouge. We'll talk with John Hardy about then and now. Also, former U.S. Senator Blanche Lambert Lincoln from the great state of Arkansas. She's now a lobbyist. We'll catch up with her on Capitol Hill. We'll also hear from Aaron Greenwald of the Historic New Orleans Collection, a major find from the Historic New Orleans Collection that Aaron has been involved with over the last few years. And we'll talk with Nathan Tan. He is the author of The Forgetful Gentleman. All this, but now the news on 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge.
You're listening to an encore performance of The Jim Engster Show, so please hold your calls.
This is Jim Engster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. 297-5633 is your number. 877-217-5757 outside the area. EngsterShow@WRKF.org. If you're trying to reach us online, we welcome that as well. Kevin Gallagher producing on the 70th birthday of former U.S. Congressman Wilbert Billy Tozan. And in studio is a man much younger, John Hardy, film producer, who's been around the film world for some time, and it all started right here in Baton Rouge, where he now lives once again. Good morning to you, John.
Good morning, Jim.
Well, 25 summers ago, 25 years ago on Chime Street and all around this city, this unknown film was being produced, called Sex, Lies, and Videotape. At that time, though, I guess it wasn't Sex, Lies, and Videotape. It was just like an idea that was coming to fruition.
Well, you mean the title? The title was there for sure from the beginning. But actually, when we were producing it here in Baton Rouge, I changed the title for some folks because I was a little afraid that some of our friends here in town who were renting me their homes and wouldn't like the word sex in the title. And so I changed it to Lies and Videotape and had T-shirts even made with that to say the same. And I remember when a gentleman I rented a home from on Eugene Street, I gave him the insurance papers so we could see that we were covered and so forth, and he looked down at the certificate, and he says here, sex, lies, and videotape. And I had to start doing a little dance at that point. I'm not really trying to pull anything over on you, but in fact, that is the title of our film.
Well, it was a relatively low-budget film. And, of course, it won the top award at the Cannes Film Festival in 1989. $1.2 million is what I see, is what it cost to make that film. By today, that's chump change. Even then, it was a low-budget production, wasn't it?
Well, it was a low-budget production. It was a different world back then. There weren't the $170 million movies that I worked on since, but $1.2 million is a good deal of money, no matter what. I mean, there are plenty of films made for that now, as you know.
You had trouble getting the $1.2 million, didn't you?
It wasn't me particularly who was raising the money. There's quite a long backstory for every film, and this one included. And it started out at being a production of Mike Curb.
Yeah, I remember that.
Who was lieutenant governor of California one time and now is a big record producer in Nashville.
And you got the money, you made the film. How did you and Steven Soderbergh come together?
Well, now, I was going to say Mike Curb, he dropped out. It was going to be done in black and white. It was going to be shot by Wade Hanks, who's a cameraman from New Orleans. And he ultimately dropped out. He got cold feet. But some of the other producers, Morgan Mason and Nick Wexler and Nancy Tenenbaum, stayed on board and raised the money through RCA Columbia Pictures. But Steven had been on all along because he wrote the screenplay, and that was the thing that got it going, and it usually is the thing that gets films going.
Right.
Small, independent films, anyway, because the writing is what shows the talent.
And well, this was his first film. He's 50 years old now. He was 25 then in the summer of 88. In the cast, all of whom have gone on to great success. At the time, the only one who was really known at all was Andy McDowell, and that was primarily through her modeling career. And I recall seeing them at Louis Cafe and other venues around Chime Street 25 years ago. I didn't know who the heck they were until I found out later.
Right. Annie McDowell, I think, had was a lovely woman and a good actress. Mm-hmm. She had been in Tarzan, a version of Tarzan with Christopher Lambert.
Yeah.
And sadly, her entire role was dubbed out by somebody else, and which is, I guess, the ultimate insult for an actor, which she didn't deserve at all. But then
they
she
didn't
did
like
become
her southern accent, did they?
Well, I guess not.
But it was beautiful in Sex Lies and Videotape.
She did a fantastically great job in a very difficult role. James Spader also, and Peter Gallagher, who became a good friend of mine. And Laura San Giacomo, this was her first role, and she showed up, and I'd pick up everybody at the airport. We had this huge staff that included me, and I would pick everyone up at the airport, and I remember picking her up in particular, and I made a deal with what was then called the Residence Inn on Corporate Boulevard, where everyone stayed, and the first day, I gave her her little envelope of per diem, which is like cash money for, and she thought that that was her paycheck.
Mm-hmm.
She had no really idea about how any of this worked.
Well, several years ago, I was at your partner Sonny Cranch's house, and he showed me a beautiful house, and he showed me his bedroom, and he said, "Do you recognize this room?" And I said, "No, Sonny, why would I recognize your bedroom?" And he says, "This is where Sex, Lies, and Videotape was filmed."
That was the bedroom for
Peter Gallagher and Laura
and Andy. Oh, well, then and Laura, who came in, and they had their tryst in the afternoon in Sonny's bedroom, which is available for immediate rental now if you want to. Sure.
Well, it's an amazing film in that it was done right here in Baton Rouge 25 years ago, and the just the term Sex, Lies, and Videotape, you hear that all the time. It has truly taken a life of its own.
That expression is something, lies, and videotape.
Mm-hmm.
Right, it's part of the vernacular, I guess.
It's like anytime there's a political scandal, it's a gate. You know, travel gate, water gate, and there are all kinds of gates. But your Sex, Lies, and Videotape is a phrase that is used over and over in various incarnations, and it all began 25 years ago with John Hardy and Steven Soderbergh. Did you know you had something, or was this kind of like, let's just see what happens?
I think we did know we had something. I knew Steven was certainly very talented, and a young man who I had made another movie before in Israel. I had produced a movie. I'd gone to film school in London and worked and came back and worked in advertising here, and I hired Steven to shoot commercials for me. He worked at a place called Video Park, and he was a cameraman. Park Seward on that. And Steven was the star over there. And we would talk all the time about filmmaking. And ultimately, I guess I was the only one in town who had actually produced a feature before. And so when it came time to put the thing together, I went out to L.A. the first time with this Mike Curb episode and started putting together the budget and so forth. And we came back, and he had pulled the plug. And then suddenly is resurrected by Bobby Neumeier and this whole other group. And Steven was intent on shooting it in Baton Rouge because he just liked the idea of being in a town that he knew with a bunch of people that he knew. And I think he was right. It had a whole sort of, it wasn't set in Baton Rouge per se. But it was like any town USA, any southern town USA.
You never named Baton Rouge in the film, but
no, and you wouldn't know it. And Peter Gallagher is a New Yorker, and you know whatever else. But that's kind of our town. We're quite a cosmopolitan, polyglot town anyway, aren't we?
Even then, 25 years ago,
yeah.
Buddy Romer was in his first year as governor of Louisiana, and right there on the streets of Baton Rouge, near the campus primarily, there were some scenes at ZZ Gardens as well. I remember that. And Kevin, why don't we give a listen to one of the scenes briefly from Sex, Lies, and Videotape?
Forget about the sex. You know, I'm not the same person that I was, even remotely. You know, I'm different in so many ways. They have a profound effect on the way that I relate to other people, communicate. I mean, for this, for instance,
in the way she and I are talking, could never have been possible.
The way she and I are talking. She, who's she?
I'm sorry, that isn't what I was talking
about. She's Elizabeth? Is that who it is? Is that the girl that John talked about? Is that who it is?
I guess.
So you're still in contact with her then?
No, I'm...
So what do you think Elizabeth is going to think about all these videotapes?
Andy McDowell and James Spader. He was named Best Actor, wasn't he, at the Cannes Film
Festival? At Cannes, yes, he was. Uh-huh. And I thought that was Kevin speaking at first. In the next room.
They sound a little alike. I think Spader's got more money, though.
That scene, and Stephen would always, you could hear the way Spader was phrasing his dialogue, and was very hesitant, and which was all part of his mm-hmm. character, and he would close his eyes and put his hand to his forehead and look off into space, and Stephen kept saying, I don't think he wants to say this dialogue. Is why it was that way.
There are some classic lines in that film, and I'm paraphrasing, but I remember one when Peter Gallagher says to James Spader, says, I should have known you were trouble when you showed up here looking like an undertaker for the art crowd.
That's right.
Yeah.
Undertaker for the art crowd.
But, and we got a question here from Bill at LSU. He wants to know about the film that came later with you and Steven Soderbergh here in Baton Rouge, at least one of them. I think all of it was filmed here, and we talk about low budget. This was no budget, wasn't it? Schizopolis,
right.
Yeah.
Which was...
which is kind of a cult classic now.
It is, and it's available for immediate sale. I've got some in my car outside. But that was a film. Also, as you say, shot here, it was kind of a reaction by Steven to... the Hollywood route that we had all been taking, and he wanted to get back to his roots, so to speak, and just throw away all the, and just make a handmade film. Mm-hmm. And Casey Silver, who was chairman of Universal Pictures, was a good friend, and he offered to pay a couple of $100,000, and we went out and bought camera equipment and the two lights, and David Jensen and Paul Ledford and Sonny's house again, and my house.
And a lot of Jimmy Weatherford of Louis is featured quite prominently in that film.
He is, with his pants off, I think. That's right.
Twice, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah, so... That's what he's probably more known for than being the proprietor of Louis all these years.
That is a very interesting film, but it's kind of a homage to Richard Lester, if you know filmmaking.
Okay. 297-5633 for John Hardy, who's been not only involved in Sex, Lies, and Videotape, but films like Out of Sight, Aaron Brockovich, Ocean's 11. We'll talk with him about his career and where the industry is going and how it's doing right here in Louisiana. back in 90 seconds.
You're listening to an encore performance of The Jim Engster Show, so please hold your calls.
This is Jim Engster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge, 297-5633. John Hardy is our guest, film producer. He, of course, started right here in Baton Rouge, and he's been involved in many endeavors involving production work, and he has worked with Sonny Cranch, one of the fine people in our community, but he is known worldwide for his work with Steven Soderbergh and some work that he did independently. He's been back in Baton Rouge for a few years, and what are you doing now?
Well, I'm producing a play. That's what I'm gotten into the theatrical stage world, thanks in part to a failure to produce a film version of A Confederacy of Dunces, which is a very long saga that involves many more than myself, but I was I was involved in several iterations of that over the last decades, and so I was actually approached by Chris Stelly, and who was a guest on your show the other day, and Philip Mann, who's in the economic development for live performance, and they said to me, "Well, look, why don't you forget about making a movie about A Confederacy of Dunces, the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel published by LSU Press, and try to get the stage rights?" And I said, "That, you know, that's a good idea. I know nothing about that business. Why don't I try that?"
Well, it's a great story. When did John Kennedy Toole write it? Do you know? It obviously was published after his death, but...
I guess he committed suicide in like 69. Is that right?
I think so.
Was teaching down at Dominican and University of Louisiana, USL at the time in the 60s. And it was published by LSU Press in, I think, 1980.
And it won the Pulitzer Prize.
Won the Pulitzer Prize, yeah.
297-5633 for John Hardy, Phil in Jefferson Terrace. Hi, Phil. You're on the air with John.
Good morning, gentlemen. Thank you. What a delightful subject to be talking about. John, I think I know where one of those old T-shirts is that was mislabeled on purpose. And I know that when that film was shot, there were some really hot, hot, hot days. And a lot of people had to get used to the heat. I just want to say that thank goodness that we can nurture. I don't know if we can claim credit for all the creative craziness and the loons that come out of Louisiana and New Orleans and the South in general, but thank goodness that it gets nurtured and allowed to flourish.
Well, you were part of the team, Phil. I know Phil does some work.
I think, is that Phil Beard?
I think it is.
Yeah. Yes, he was.
Well, it was a hot summer in 1988, and it was a hot film. And I don't know if you knew what you had, but it has taken a life of its own and is now, it's not only I called Schizopolis a cult classic, this is a classic. And people will be watching Sex, Lies, and Videotape 100 years from now. You were named one of America's top 50 producers by a couple of publications. And yet you came back to Baton Rouge a few years ago. That's the last time we talked with you on this show. Mm-hmm. And I thought for sure at some point shortly thereafter you'd be heading back to California, but you've stayed.
I did stay. And for various reasons, I think at the time Louisiana was starting to heat up as a production center. And I actually came here in 2007 to do a feature with Bertrand Tavernier, the great mm-hmm. French director, with Tommy Lee Jones playing Dave Robichaux in a James Lee Burke novel turned into a film called In the Electric Mist. And it was a wonderful experience, and it was one of the early days of the film credit program. I decided to make the move and stay. And I guess, as I tell my wife and my friends, I've been working ever since, but not getting paid ever since.
Well, what do you think of the industry going forward in Louisiana and as a whole?
I think the industry is being fragmented into some odd mutations. That is, the gigantic films that are really children's films that are hyped up and amped up to be sold to younger men, and then there's all the digital capability that allows anyone else to make a film. So there's this huge gap between what the big money is put into and the marketplace that won't absorb all the thousands and thousands of films that are produced by people on their own.
What's the last really good film you've seen, John?
Life of Pi.
You like that?
Yeah. And I was also a great admirer of Benjamin Button, frankly. I've got to say,
Brad Pitt.
With Brad Pitt and the whole the look of that film, which was shot, it was an early digital film.
Well, for those who are unfamiliar with John, he not only worked many years with Steven Soderbergh, but he's the brother of Beth Courtney of LPP, and your father was quite a man. He must have had quite an influence on your life.
Well, he did. He was an Air Force general, and he passed away last year.
At
99.
Right. Wow.
He was he's healthier than I was. I think he didn't, he had a great influence like all fathers do, and here comes Father's Day, but like all fathers do on their children, he didn't have any idea of the film business or such, of course, but just being around him and moving around the world the way we did brought a hold worldview that I carry to this day. That's why I went back to film school in London, because I knew England so well, because I'd gone to high school there, and I did a movie there later on as well. And all that was due, I guess, initially to my father moving us around the way he did or had to do.
Well, thank you for gracing us with your talent, spending time with us this morning. We look forward to the next chapter for John Hardy, and it'll be a play with Confederacy of Dunces. Who's going to be the lead actor?
Well, we're doing a workshop next week, starting next week in New Orleans, and my director, David S. Bjornson, writer Jeffrey Hatcher, are all coming down, and it's John Spud McConnell is going to take the role for this workshop.
Great. That's great. He's, of course, very good. Now a talk show host.
Yeah.
And I think you got some great years ahead. So thank you, John.
Thank you.
Take care, my friend. Good to visit with you. Now we're joined by former U.S. Senator Blanche Lincoln of the great state of Arkansas. She served two terms as a U.S. Senator, 1999 to 2011, and two terms as a U.S. Congressperson from Arkansas. Good morning, Senator Lincoln.
Good morning. Delighted to be with you.
Well, nice to talk with you. And you are now chair of a group called It's My Business Coalition. What are you doing in this capacity?
Well, it's a wonderful opportunity to really bring some awareness to the phenomenal men and women across this country in nearly every sector of the economy who choose to actually organize themselves as a small business, particularly an independent contractor. And what we're trying to do is to, really bring about the awareness of, one, the fact that over the past several years, as we've been trying to rebuild our economy, although we've got great corporations, it's not the larger corporations that are really producing the jobs in this country right now. It's the new small businesses, including independent contractors, that have been responsible for nearly all of the net growth of U.S. employment, and we've seen that in recent studies. So one of the things that we're trying to bring about an awareness is The volume of regulations, and particularly some of those that are coming out of Washington, that create such uncertainty for our independent contractors. They don't have full-time compliance officers and full-time lawyers or legal teams, but they are working hard on slimmer margins than big major corporations. And we just want to make sure that there's an awareness out there and that we can keep people abreast of the things that are going on that can really hamper those that are truly the engines of our economy right now. So we've got a great website. It's www.itsmybusiness.com, and encouraging folks to go to it and learn more and certainly participate in our efforts to ensure that what's coming out of Washington is less uncertainty and something that's more in terms of enhancing their ability to grow the jobs and help rebuild our economy.
Well, what kind of challenges do small businesses face that are most profound at this time, Senator?
Well, the one that they state in most all the polls that have been taken, their number one issue is the uncertainty of regulations that are coming out of Washington. As you know, once we pass major legislation in Washington, it then goes to the agencies to have rules and regulations written to hopefully complement the intent of what the legislation was that was passed by their elected officials. The problem becomes is that when it gets to these agencies, oftentimes you've got agencies that you've got folks that have been there for 25, 30 years who really have not been out in the workforce and in the world to really know what the changes are that are going on in terms of competition and technologies and a whole host of other things. So they're good people, those folks that work in our agencies. There's no doubt that government workers are good people and they want to do the best, but their exposure to really knowing what the challenges are for small businesses is limited. And so it's critical that what we do is encourage these agencies and the administration. And I think, President Obama has mentioned more than once the idea of trying to reform regulations and make government smarter. We want to encourage that to happen. And particularly for independent contractors, we want to make sure we don't create problems unnecessarily that are really going to inhibit their ability to grow jobs. That's really what our effort is. It's to really focus on what's going on. We know that there's been some resources dedicated to the IRS and to the Labor Department trying to rewrite some of the rules on independent contractors. We just think that needs to be done in conjunction with independent contractors and small businesses so that, again, inadvertently, we don't create things that are going to be debilitatory towards the very people who are helping to drive our economy back to a good, solid, productive economy.
We're visiting with former U.S. Senator Blanche Lambert Lincoln from Arkansas. She served two terms in the United States Senate, two terms as a U.S. Congresswoman from Arkansas, was on Capitol Hill continuously from 1993 to 2011. Do you miss it? Do you miss being an elected official at the highest levels of our government?
Well, the thing I miss the most is the problem solving. I came to Congress, quite frankly, without any political background. I've been a staffer on the Hill. I'm enormously proud of our government and the system that was put into place, over 200 years ago, to really provide the kind of process of committee work and questions and real debate about, what is going to work best, finding the consensus, and I think that's most important. I really truly believe that real leadership creates an environment where people feel comfortable coming to the table with their different ideas and working together. And I think that's what we really need more of in Washington. So I miss my friends and I miss that problem solving. I don't miss the political bickering. It was never, one of my favorite parts of it anyway. But I do miss the problem solving, and these are places where I can still be helpful in terms of problem solving, and that is really trying to bring about a greater awareness of the mechanisms in government and how they work. You know, one of the things that we really want to see with the regulatory process in these agencies is, you know, better science, making sure that we're using good data, making sure that we are looking at the benefit versus the cost of what it's going to be to those who really churn the engines of our economy, and that's business and industries that create the jobs. You know, everybody wants safe working conditions and clean water and clean air and all of those things, and they are very, very important. But we have to be smart about how we do that. And quite frankly, if you look globally, we're doing a better job than most anybody out there in the global economy and the global community. So, you know, it's important that we, however, in these economic times, to be more competitive globally, that we're paying attention to what we're doing and how we're doing it. And I think oftentimes people don't realize who these small businesses and independent contractors are. You know, they're an enormous group of individuals, financial services, real estate, right, transportation, medical and health services. Maybe the person that delivered your newspaper this morning was an independent contractor.
Now, Laura, Senator, wants to know how well you know Senator Landrieu. I'm sure you know her quite well.
Senator Landrieu?
Yes.
Yes, absolutely. Mary's a good friend of mine.
She, like you, was or is a conservative Democrat, although some might bicker with that description, but I think it's accurate, and faces reelection in a state that's gone red, as your state did. Will she have the same challenge as you did?
Well, you know, I think anybody that's a moderate, whether they're Democrat or Republican, if you're looking for consensus, you have a problem with the extremes. I don't believe that going to the extremes is the best way to, grow our economy and provide the kind of progress that we need. I think it does stem from finding consensus, and that's, I think, what moderates do. So, you know, Senator Landrieu has always been a champion for small business. She's chairman of the Small Business Committee and works really hard to really focus on what their needs are. Olympia Snow, who I also work tremendously well as a moderate Republican, did the same thing, working towards, you know, really finding the solutions, solving those problems for small businesses across this country, because we know them. We, you know, most of us have grown up in states like Arkansas, Louisiana, and Maine, where you do have rural areas. Olympia and I used to always find that we had so many similarities in our states. So you're right. It's important to make sure that you're working hard, and I think in that moderate realm is where the problems are solved.
Well, Senator Blanche Lincoln is now chair of It's My Business Coalition. Senator, once again, the website is?
www.itsmybusiness.com. And it's a great place for people to find information as small business and particularly independent contractors and make themselves aware and to work with us to bring about a greater awareness of the wonderful job that they do across this country, working hard to create jobs, and more importantly, how we can make government smarter and better for them.
Well, thank you, Senator. Good to visit with you. Hope we talk again soon.
It's great to be with you.
Take care. We'll be back in 90 seconds.
You're listening to an encore performance of The Jim Engster Show, so please hold your calls.
This is Jim Engster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge, and our guest at this time is Erin Greenwald. She is curator and historian at the Historic New Orleans Collection. She joined the collection in 2007 and has been involved with numerous publications, and we'll get to one that is out and about right now, a graduate of The Ohio State University, where she received her Ph.D., a few years ago. Dr. Greenwald, good morning to you.
Good morning.
Well, tell us first of all about the New Orleans collection, one of the real jewels of the city of New Orleans and the state of Louisiana, tucked nicely in the French Quarter. It's a prominent part of our culture, isn't it?
Absolutely is. The Historic New Orleans Collection is a museum, research center, and publisher dedicated to the history and preservation of New Orleans and the Gulf South. We support numerous projects throughout the community, especially those interested in preserving our city. And we have a very active exhibition schedule. We host probably four different exhibitions annually. Next week, we open Pipe Dreams, Louisiana under the Company of the Indies. And, you know, we have constantly programming going on at the collection.
Founded in 1966, the Historic New Orleans Collection is a museum, research center, and publisher dedicated to preserving the history and culture of New Orleans and the Gulf South. And it's located in the heart of the French Quarter, and we're visiting with the curator, Aaron Greenwald, Dr. Aaron Greenwald. And I know of at least one person here in Baton Rouge who has artifacts from his own life, having grown up in Europe during the reign of Nazi Germany. And he has told me that he is delivering those at the appropriate time to the Historic New Orleans Collection. I suppose you invite that kind of participation.
We absolutely do. You know, our collection started based on the private collection of General Kemper Williams and his wife, Leela. And that core collection was made up primarily of maps and documents related to French colonial Louisiana and also the Battle of New Orleans. That's our core collection. And since then, we have grown tremendously. And one of the ways we grow is through donations, of course. And people from all over the country and, in fact, all over the world seek us out as a place to deposit and preserve their family papers, their photographs. You know, this is a good example that you've pointed out of an individual donating family possessions to the Historic New Orleans Collection. But we also take in gifts from photographers, from historical figures from the 20th century. So we have a very large, wide-ranging collection scope.
So what happens if I want to see this man's collection at a time in the distant future, 10 years from now, let's say? Will they be available for public viewing?
Sure, absolutely. So, you know, we take in collections both to preserve but also to exhibit. So many times you'll see objects that have come in on display. But if they're not on display, you can always go to the Williams Research Center at 410 Charter Street, and that is our archive. You can go up to the desk and request to see whatever it is you're interested in seeing.
Well, the latest work that our guest, Dr. Aaron Greenwald, is involved with is a beautiful book called A Company Man: The Remarkable French Atlantic Voyage of a Clerk from the Company of the Indies. This is a magnificent-looking book, and, of course, the information inside is even more remarkable. What prompted you to embark on this endeavor?
Well, in 2004, the Historic New Orleans Collection acquired a manuscript. It's an 184-folio-page French manuscript accompanied by 13 watercolors, documenting a young man's account of his experiences here in New Orleans between 1729 and 1731. This was in December of 2004. Of course, Hurricane Katrina hit in August of 2005. We were the first museum to reopen in the city of New Orleans. And very quickly, the publications department and the curatorial staff sought to figure out more about this document. So in 2006, a translator was hired, Terry Chalmers. And when I came on in 2007, the director of publications asked me to take a look at the very first drafts of the translation, which I did. My background is in French colonial history. And when I started to read this, I thought to myself, can this possibly be for real? And that led to me spending the next 5 years of my professional career figuring out who the author was. When we purchased it at auction, we only had his last name. So it was a wild goose chase through 9 different archives in France, Canada, and the United States, determining and confirming the author's identity, and then, of course, building out the context of the world in which he lived and wrote.
Well, the man is Marc Antoine Caillot.
That's right.
And at the age of 21, he left his family in Paris to embark on an overseas adventure. His assignment to Louisiana was hardly coveted. The colony was one of the company's least desirable destinations, thanks to the unforgiving climate and limited resources, and its capital, New Orleans, at that time, was only a decade old. It's a fascinating story.
It really is. It really absolutely is.
And his intended audience was not those who are listening to this radio show right now.
Right. And, you know, that's audience is a good thing for us to talk about, because one of the reasons this manuscript is so incredible is that it was written for an intimate circle of friends. So it wasn't written for an administrator or a military officer or in an attempt to give him a leg up professionally, which means that it's not censored and it didn't go through the crown and royal censor. So we get this very, very kind of naked view of what it was like to live here, what it was like to cross the Atlantic. You know, this guy was a tremendous womanizer, and he writes about that in detail. So we get a real sense of what interpersonal relationships were like in the 18th century, and it certainly shows us that it was not a stuffy time to be living in.
It doesn't sound like it. Have you pinpointed the exact time when he wrote this manuscript?
He wrote the manuscript sometime between when he left Louisiana in 1731 and his death in a shipwreck in 1758. I suspect that the manuscript was written very shortly after he left the colony, because within 8 months of arriving back in France in 1732, he was recommissioned to a position as a clerk in India, where he spent the rest of his professional career working with the Company of the Indies.
So this manuscript was penned before the United States became a country, certainly well before the Louisiana Purchase of 1803. And this man, Marc Antoine Caillou, was a young man, but at that time, 51, that was the age he was when he died, was considered to be an old man. And he died, as you said, in a shipwreck off the coast of India.
He died in a shipwreck off the coast of India, and all of this came forward through the research that I did for this book. He worked his way up through the company hierarchy in India. First, he began as a clerk, and he worked up to an assistant trader and then a full merchant trader, and finally ended up on the Pondicherry Superior Council, which is the highest governing body for the French Company of the Indies in the Indian Ocean. He died likely escaping the Seven Years' War, which is really the first international world war. Here in the United States, we call it the French and Indian War. And the campaigns were fought in Europe, in North America, but also in India. And the French ended up losing much of their holdings here in North America and also in India. And he died aboard a ship that was leaving from the Indian coast.
Well, Marc Antoine Caillou was born June 4th, 1707, in France, in a small village located 2 leagues from Paris. That's 2.4 miles in a short carriage ride from where the action was. And his father held the office of the first footman in what was the group, the Chateau?
So it's the Chateau de Meudon. His father was the first footman to Louis XIV's eldest son, Monseigneur le Dauphin. Now, of course, Louis XIV outlived all of his sons, basically, and ended up passing the throne onto his 5-year-old great-grandson in 1715. And so Marc Antoine Caillou, this clerk, received the commission as a clerk with the company as a patronage position because of his family's relationship to the crown.
The book is A Company Man, and it is just out, The Remarkable French Atlantic Voyage of a Clerk for the Company of the Indies. And the memoir from Marc Antoine Caillou was edited by our guest, Dr. Aaron Greenwald. And this narrative is perhaps one of the most significant finds in a century, more than a century?
I would say that it's safe to say that in more than a century, historians and archives have not seen something of this significance. It's very, very rare to find a new source for the French colonial period of this length, especially, and especially since it comes with 13 watercolors, which we have reproduced in the book. Very lucky to have been supported by the Historic New Orleans Collection. It's not every day that publishers at this point in time include full color foldouts of every image that you'd like to include, and they certainly did, and I think it really makes it a spectacular presentation. It's a great Father's Day gift, in fact.
It is a remarkable book and a remarkable story. You went to France a few times on your
research, didn't
you?
I did, yes. You know, like I said, we didn't have anything but his last name. And so there were several trips to France to narrow down the pool of possible Caillou candidates. and especially in the region of Meudon, which is the area where we knew he was from because he talks about it in his account. And I went through sacramental records, notarial archives, wills and successions, tax rolls. And, you know, I finally had the eureka moment when I was in Aix-en-Provence at the Overseas Archives and found Caillaux's name as an exact signature match on an early 1750s census record from India.
That's right.
So it's quite a story, and one that has been unearthed by the Historic New Orleans Collection. And this has been your baby for the last few years.
It has. I don't know what I'm going to do now.
And it's out and about, big book, and it's beautiful and with a great story. And for those who have an affinity for history, and in particular the history of the great city of New Orleans, this is something that stands right there with the best of them. For those who would like to peruse a copy, the best way to find a company man is?
Best way to find a company man, if you're in the Baton Rouge area, is at the City Place Barnes & Noble. I'll be at a signing at 1 o'clock on Saturday, June 15th, at the City Place Barnes & Noble. Otherwise, if you can't make it to the signing, it's available through the collections website, which is hnoc.org, and through major online retailers.
Well, Erin, we thank you for joining us today, and Dr. Greenwald, congratulations on a fine work, and I'm sure many of our listeners will be eager to meet you come Saturday at Barnes & Noble City Place.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you. And we switch gears now. We're joined by Nathan Tan, another fascinating gentleman who's written a compelling work called The Forgetful Gentleman. Good morning, Nathan.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
30 Ways to Turn Good Intentions into Action. The Modern Man, says Nathan, has good intentions, but we lack the tools to turn them into gentlemanly action. What do we need to do?
Well, I think it's just a matter of, helping. We need some help, right? We have great intentions. We don't struggle for good intentions, but the modern world is presenting us with all sorts of new social situations, all sorts of new social challenges, and we don't always know how best to act, to turn our intentions into action. And so the intent with this book is, let's take those intentions, make it very easy to turn them into action, a wide-ranging group of topics, because today's gentleman really is wide-ranging in his interests. So everything from dressing well to etiquette to dating to relationships to mentoring, to more philosophical things like how to live with intention and purpose, developing personal philosophy. Mm-hmm. So really a wide range, and hopefully compelling, not only as an enjoyable read, but as a catalyst to action.
You think we should, as modern men, be able to work out like a Navy SEAL and also be capable of mixing a signature cocktail?
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. The workout like a Navy SEAL was inspired by the best man at my wedding, and my best friend for years, who is in SEAL training and has been obviously in elite fitness shape and has taken me out on occasion to work out. And I, on the other hand, refer to myself as a retired athlete. I'm not terribly active anymore, and the disparity was shocking. And so there are some interesting tips there on how to work out, even if you don't. Aren't a Navy SEAL, but can put yourself in better shape. And the cocktail thing, as I was recounting some memorable experiences, it was interesting to me that each one, or it seemed like very often, a signature drink could be tied to those memories. And so the idea here is not so much about the drink; it's more about the drink facilitating a great experience with friends or family, mm-hmm. and having those memories live on.
Nathan, you say that being a contemporary gentleman is a subtle art. How so?
Well, I think, and something that I talk about often is that even though gentleman or gentlemanliness often evokes the Victorian era, I often say that today actually might be the gentleman's golden age. And the reason I say that is because in previous times, a lot of the behaviors or actions that we talk about when they refer to gentlemanliness were expected or were normal. And things that are normal and expected are rarely celebrated. In today's world, for better or worse, a lot of those things are no longer expected or normal. And so the gentleman today has an interesting opportunity to make some subtle changes in the way that he dresses or approaches social situations or in his interests that can really differentiate him in powerful ways, not only in his personal life, but also in the business world.
You say that being a good conversationalist is essential.
Yeah, absolutely. It's been said that we miss somewhere between a dismal 50 to 75% of a conversation simply by thinking about what we want to say next rather than listening to our conversational partner. And so conversations are obviously a great way to deepen and enrich relationships. And if we're missing 50 to 75%, it's a huge opportunity.
The book is The Forgetful Gentleman, a great read for Father's Day. Thank you, Nathan Tan, and thank you for listening, everybody. Hope you have a great weekend. We'll be back Monday. Stay tuned.
Podcasts of The Jim Engster Show are available at WRKF.org. The Jim Engster Show is produced in association with the Louisiana Radio Network and is copyrighted by WRKF for the private use of its audience. Any other use of any portion of this program without the written consent of WRKF is prohibited. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the views of WRKF, its officers, and members.